that already, but now we're going to add to that. The European Space Agency has a telescope that they would like to put into space, but they just got funded for a while back, and it's going to launch in 2028, called Ariel, and it's atmospheric remote sensing infrared exoplanet large surveyor. So it's a telescope with a meter, a little over a meter diameter mirror. But it's not a round mirror. It's going to be oval shaped. Now, I never saw that before. So this oval shaped mirror is going to be roughly 4 feet wide by around 2.5 feet. You know, you're going to create an oval out of this. And they're going to put this into a spacecraft, and they're going to launch it to the L2, Lagrange Point 2 location. So a million miles out away from Earth, so it won't be revolving around Earth. But it'll be sitting out at a point where it'll be actually revolving around the sun. So due to the gravitational equalization at that point, you don't need very much fuel to keep it located in that halo. They call it a halo orbit at L2. So it turns out NASA has now got funding. You know, where we're talking about funding problems, but they are able to fund this one. This is a, they call it CASE. CASE is another, you gotta take that word CASE and it'll be one that I have here. Contribution to Ariel Spectroscopy, the extra planets and CASE, and it just goes on and on. They have more acronyms than you can shake a stick at. But it's really an infrared spectroscope. That's what it is. And it's going to be part of the European Space Agency telescope when launched. And the idea of this is to look at roughly 1,000 planets. They want to start by looking at it in this four-year program. And they're going to try to look at the atmospheres, and this thing will be so sensitive, they'll be able to use the spectrograph to tell the, you know, what atmosphere is in these planets by two ways of doing it. One, when the planet gets in front of the sun, the light rays from the sun will pass through the atmosphere of the planet, and the spectroscope will be able to determine what's in it. And also, when the planet goes behind the sun, right before it goes behind the sun, they're going to be able to get information that way as well. So, you know, it's a long way off, but we'll have James Webb Space Telescope out there doing similar type of work. But this is a European Space Agency version. In case the James Webb Space Telescope doesn't work out, I mean, that thing is so complicated. It's got 87 different pyrotechnics that have to go off to put James Webb out there successfully. All kinds of origami type of structures have to open up and reconnect, and have to be aligned with laser preciseness I don't know. I just hope that thing works out. It's being built by Northrop Grumman. And that's expected to launch in 2021 to the same location, the L2, Lagrange Point 2. But this will be actually a more advanced one. This is supposed to have a better spectroscope on this. And they don't have a cooling problem like the James Webb. They do have all kinds of layered pieces to this to try to keep the heat away from it. But the James Webb actually has a direct refrigeration type system on board to bring it down to the extra cold temperature. I think down to 3 Kelvin or something, or even lower than that. This one won't be, you know, this will be just whatever temperature you would call, you know, down to, I think it's minus 300 78 degrees or something. I read it somewhere, but cold. And hopefully that works out. Any questions on the case? I think all the case part of the of this telescope. Okay, nothing heard. Another successful launch last Monday of the Starlink program. Earlier we talked about the satellites and how they were going to communicate with KA and KU band capability. SpaceX launched another 60 satellites. They have 60 up already. They just added another 60. They need around 1,200 to start operations where they can start selling broadband capability across the United States. They're starting at around 53 degrees inclination, which gives them roughly the center of the planet. They plan on covering the whole United States with that. You know, they probably won't kill Alaska, but you know, most of the United States will be able to work these satellites. And that's another 60 out of 1,200. They eventually plan to put 30,000 of these things up, and 12,000 to be worldwide capable. In other words, everybody from the Antarctica to you know, Pango Pango out in the middle of nowhere will be able to get on the internet, get 4K TV. They'll get their TV, they'll get their phone communication, everything that you would normally get through cable, you're going to be able to get through Starlink. These 30,000 some odd satellites, now 60 more were added, now 120 now in orbit, have crash avoidance systems. You know, they know how far the other satellites are away from them. They know how far commercial satellites are. This way they won't interfere with other systems. They have Hall thrusters on board to save fuel. They use the Hall thrusters or ion thrusters. And they'll be able to move to you know, precise locations. And if they get out of the way, they'll be able to turn the ion thruster on and move it out of the way. They have one solar array that comes, you know, most satellites, you always see two solar has just one big long solar array that comes down and supplies the energy for transmissions and for operating the Hall thruster. They're small satellites. They weigh 573 pounds each. They have the phased array antennas, so it's a very flat type of setup. If you look at the satellites, you know, you don't see any parabolic dish or anything. It just looks like a one flat dish, slightly curved, but pretty flat. And being a phased, electronically phased array, they can use spot beam, you know, any way they want from wherever they go. And like Dick talked about earlier, they do have the mesh capability to talk into one another. And I believe they, I don't know if it's these or maybe the later models, are also going to be able to communicate with each other using laser, communication. So I thought that was pretty good. As far as the engineering of putting these satellites up in space, you know, just to get this thing where you're going to get these thousand satellites or so up there, he needs to put 24 launches up. He plans on doing that next year. So, you know, you could theoretically start buying broadband at the end of next year, maybe January of the following year. So he's going to have 24 launches next year. You know, you're going to see your regular SpaceX launches. They launch for NASA all the time. They launch for the Defense Department. They'll put up spy satellites, whatever it is. They launch for commercial companies across the world. different countries. They'll have the regular launches, but in between all these launches, they're going to add another 24 launches next year. Most they've ever launched, I think, is 18 in 1 year. So their manifest is really going to be full, and they have factory set up, punching out these satellites like cookies, and shipping them to Florida, and eventually to Vandenberg Air Force Base down in California. So they'll be able to launch from two different locations. They're using the upgraded version, they call it the Block 5 version of the Falcon 9, rocket. So that's been all upgraded over the last couple of years. They haven't launched an earlier version in a couple of years now. All the ones that are going up now, this Block 5 version of the Falcon 9, have the capability of being reused 10 times, and then after 10 times, they'll bring them in and, you know, really work them over. And then put them back out for use again for another 10 flights. And he's getting there. This last flight that just went up successfully last Monday, launched from Launch Complex 40. He's got two launch complexes in Florida, but this one went from Launch Complex 40. It's the fourth launch of this particular booster. So, you know, it's gone up before, come down, landed, brought it back, put gas in it, put liquid oxygen in it, and off it goes again. So it's the fourth flight inside of like less than 2 years for this one particular booster. First time they've gotten up to four. Not to be outdone, he's also reused the fairings. You know, the fairings are big pieces on the top of the rocket that enclose the satellites. And these particular fairings are huge. They're 17 feet in diameter, like 47 feet tall. And they cost like $6 million each. So right from the beginning, he said eventually he's going to be able to reuse these. Now, over the last couple of years, he started with putting electronics in each fairing, and he was noting where they were coming down and how fast they were coming down. And eventually he put little thrusters on there to orient properly in space, you know, right before they re-enter the atmosphere. Then as they come down, he's got parachutes, balloon parachutes, they call them, and they come out and they're able to guide it very close to these ships, and they land in the water, and then he's got these ships that, you know, also by SpaceX, that go out and pick up these fairings. The earlier fairings were getting kind of destroyed from the salt water. Those newer ones, not so much. He's able to, insulate them properly, where they really don't get too affected from the salt water. But he would like to really keep them clean. So now he's got two of these ships out there with these gigantic nets sticking out of the top of the ship. And each net is like as big as a football field. You know, all right, I'm lying. A little smaller than that, but big. You know, if you see pictures of the of these things. They've got these four massive outriggers going out, and then this big net. So as these things come flying down from outer space, now he's got two ships, and he's going to try to land them in the ship. He has done it once. He's collected a half, when he split it, they split it to two. So he's collected one half that actually landed in a net not too long ago. But this fairing, the setup that went up, is not one of them. This is one of the ones that went up, landed in the water, rebuilt them, and then relaunched them on Monday. And sure enough, he was going to bring them back as well. Turns out it was very, very wavy out there, very extremely high waves. And he decided to bring his boats that were going to recover these fairings back to port. So he canceled that. He didn't cancel the landing of the booster, though. He sent his autonomous ship out there, and it was around 400 miles away from Florida. When the booster came down and this thing landed dead center, you know, they had live TV, I saw it live, and it landed dead center of the booster on the ship. So, another perfect landing, and they'll bring that back and they'll set it up for flight number 5. You know, you talk about bringing the cost down of space travel. This guy's really doing it, you know. I know he's got a lot of far out ideas. Some things have not come true. Some predictions he predicted he was going to do, but it didn't work out. A lot of them he predicted, they came true. Most of them late, you know, a couple of years late, but eventually they came true. So he's really pretty good. And he's the one that's working on the Starship. And that's the one he plans on eventually going to the moon or to Mars, by the way. If anybody's got a chance of making it to the moon first, yeah. The way this guy's going, he's going to be able to at least orbit the moon probably before 2024, unless he has some major problems with the Starship that he's building. But he's making a lot of headway. He's building 2 of them right now, one in Florida and one down in Texas, in Boca Chica, Texas. So, we'll see what happens with that. Another company that's very successful, and that was Manflight. That's one of Elon Musk's SpaceX goals, that Manflight. This other one, Peter Beck, he owns Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab is a company dedicated to smaller payloads. Actually, not Manflight, but, you know, he'll put up a half a dozen small satellites at a time. Doing pretty well. He hasn't had any failures yet. He launches something called the Electron Rocket, and this, I think in about 5 or 6 days, he's launching the 10th flight of the Electron Rocket. Launching that from New Zealand. He's originally from New Zealand, but he's licensed, and the whole company really comes out of the United States. He builds all these engines, these Rutherford engines, they call them, which are run by electric motors. The turbines spin up to like 1,000 RPM, but not with any kind of fuel. He uses electric motors. And each one is hooked up to its own lithium-ion batteries. So, you know, he's been launching these one after the other, and they wind up in the ocean. Not recoverable until recently he decided, well, now he's going to join the recoverable corporations for rocket launches. He's building these rockets now with parachutes. Eventually, he's going to start catching these things. They come down out of the sky with a helicopter and then bringing it over to a boat. And then bringing it back to New Zealand, where he launches them, rebuilding them, and launching them again. And his manifest is, he says, he's got a lot of launches that he has to take care of, so that's biggest reason for reusing these things. It takes maybe, he said, it was something like 40 or 50 days to build one rocket, you know. So now he wants to cut that time down, and he's got 2 ways of doing it. One, reusability, and the other one, he set up a robotic factory to, instead of doing this in like, you know, 50 days for per rocket, now he could do it in like 4 days or something. He's got some kind of a robotic system designed just to build Electron rockets. And I do have a YouTube on that. I meant to send that over to ac2gs.com. You know, roy.ac2gs. Maybe I'll do that if I remember at the end of the net. And then he can post that. It's a nice YouTube of of the Electron, the Rocket Lab Electron rocket, the way they build it, and what's involved over there. We've got one of the women that are in charge, Amanda Stiles, Director of Mission Management, and she goes on and on about, you know, what they do and how they do it. It's pretty good. But not to be outdone, they will be launching Electron rockets from American soil very shortly. My guess, by the end of this year, he should have his first launch from Wallops Island, Virginia, not too far from here. We're able to actually see launches from there. When Antares is launched by Northrop Grumman, but that's a much bigger rocket, so I don't think we're going to be able to see the Electron rocket unless we take a ride down to somewhere near Wallops Island, Virginia. Off the coast of Virginia, they're building a launch complex in that same facility, Wallops Island, the same place that they launched the Antares rocket, which has the Cygnus cargo vehicle on top that goes to the International Space Station. Any questions or comments? This is WS2N. Okay, nothing heard. I was talking about Mars before. Curiosity is riding around on Mars right now, and that's the nuclear-powered rover, and it's been doing that since 2012 now. Now here we are, 2019, and it's drilling into rocks, taking rock measurements, taking soil measurements, and it also takes atmosphere measurements, you know, for all these days. And they notice the air pressure, they notice how much carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere, mostly carbon dioxide, 95%, and there's almost 3% nitrogen, and it's talking about argon is about 2% of that, and then there's oxygen, you know. So they notice over the years, now their idea of a year on Mars is different than ours. You know, I was 300 days, and there's double that. So they have a spring, you know, they have a fall, summer, and winter on Mars. Well, they know that in the wintertime, a lot of the carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere, 95%, a lot of it condenses and then it freezes and winds up at the poles. And then you wind up with this sometimes 2-3 foot frozen carbon dioxide at the North and South Pole. What that does is it actually lowers the pressure on Mars. Pressure on Mars is, you know, roughly 0.1% of what we have on Earth. So, you know, 1/100th of it. It's a real fine number that they go by. And they know that after this carbon dioxide freezes, the pressure drops. If you had you were staying on Mars, and you look at your meter, you would see that thing drop, and it drops quite a bit overall. And a lot of the other gases, the argon, the nitrogen, you know, they follow suit with the carbon dioxide. To some degree, the pressure goes down. What's very odd is the oxygen level tends to go higher now. It's just the new discovery. They're surprised to see that during the season, you know, the oxygen level is high, and then they see the oxygen, you know, it's lower, and it should have matched, you know, the carbon dioxide when that gets frozen. But it wasn't. It was, you know, opposite. So now they're going to try to figure out where's this oxygen coming from. You know they have a methane question. They've noticed that over the years. Like I said, it's been there since 2012. They noticed that the methane levels have changed, sometimes significantly. And now the oxygen levels are. So, you know, think it was methane. Well, maybe some kind of life on the ground, you know, bacteria or who knows. And now they have the oxygen question too, you know. So, you know, is there life on Mars? We still don't know. It might be on the ground. And they said it could be a geological problem with the methane, but they can't figure out the oxygen. They don't think that that would be a geological resolve on figuring that out. So, interesting topic, but we'll find out as time goes on. Because in 2020, we have another Mars rover going up. So next year, I think in the summer of next year, they'll launch the Mars rover 2020. Very similar to Curiosity, nuclear powered. Naturally, it's all these years later, so they have better instrumentation. They have different drilling capabilities. You know, Curiosity has this big arm that can reach out. It drills into the rock, collects the powder. When you drill something, and the scoop picks it up and puts it into the SAM. SAM is one of the chemical labs inside of Curiosity. And this one's going to have the same thing, but it's also going to have core boring capabilities. You know, you take a core boring tool, and you'll be able to get these 6 or 8 inch long cores out of rock, out of the surface, that they'll be to take and store, and leave in one place. They'll know the exact locations of where they left them behind. This way, in the future, when they send a Mars rocket up there with a return vehicle, they'll be able to somehow get these samples that Mars 2020 rover is going to go up in July, probably land in January of 2021. We'll be able to take these samples and maybe eventually return them to Earth. Scientists would love to get these things back to their labs. You know, even so, the labs that they have on board Curiosity are very high tech. The lasers, all kinds of gadgets that I don't even know about are inside Curiosity. They said if they had a core sample coming back, whatever equipment we have here on Earth, it would blow Curiosity right off the face of Mars. Just terrific amount of information that they would get if they could bring some samples back. So we'll see what happens with Mars 2020. Any comments or questions? This is WS2M. Nothing heard? One other space event that I've been following is the NASA EVAs. There's a whole series of them, like lately, from a month or two ago to the end of this year, they plan at least 10, maybe 11 EVAs. They have a couple that have gone by already, three that have gone by already that were dedicated to putting new batteries on the space station. They have these massive lithium batteries that have been replacing these older nickel, nickel hydrogen batteries. They've been changing them out. Then they had a problem with one of the electronic controllers. They did the spacewalk with two women, first time the two women ever went out together, and they repaired that. That worked out perfect. There are these other EVAs. I know they have at least two more to go for batteries, but I guess that's on hold for them because it has to do with scheduling. And now they have these two astronauts that went out on Friday. Morgan and Pomitano, Luca Pomitano is from Italy. He's the one that went up a few years ago, back in 2013. He did an EVA that time, and he wound up with water in his helmet, all kinds of problems. They had to terminate the EVA. And you would think, after that, I'm not doing that anymore. He couldn't get back to space fast enough. He he's 2 years later, but now he's back up there again, and he's the head EVA walker for this mission, him and Morgan. And the mission is to repair the AMS. The AMS is the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. This $2.5 billion thing that they sent up on the second to the last shuttle flight back in 2011. They attached it to the S3 truss segment. We have truss segments along the International Space Station. They have 11 of them. Number one is called zero. The first one out is called number one. They skip number two. They have 3, 4, 5, 6 all the way out. Then going the other way, you have the same setup. You know, one direction is called S. You know, S1, S3, S4, S5. And the other way you have T. So one is starboard, one is for port. This thing's out on the starboard 3 truss segment of the space station. All the trusses, you put them together, and there was one in a football field. So out of an S3, on the top one, the zenith part, up and bottom on the space station. On the top, because it's looking up in space. And the mission of that Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer is to pick up all the free electrons, the free protons that are floating through space, and maybe even antiprotons, which it's found. And this contraption is surrounded by 6,000 magnets, neodymium magnets, and each magnet is epoxied together, and it's creating like a not a sphere, but you know, toroid type of setup. Instead of using electromagnets and then having cool electromagnets, you know, to do this, they just use regular neodymium magnets. And you know, normally your positrons, electrons flying through space, you know, they go straight. You know, they follow the curvature of space, for instance. So what they have is this magnet, and as these particles pass through the center of it, they have all these different coils, and the coils pick up the difference as they go through, and the coils act as detectors, and they can tell where they're coming from, what type of particles they are, the mass, and you know, they can figure out what it is and how many of them are, and through this they're studying dark matter and maybe even dark energy. So apparently this one physicist, some Nobel laureate, maybe you can put a T, I forgot what it is, you know, Roy would know it, he's the one that designed all this and pushed forward for many years. He got the first one built, the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer number one. That was put on a shuttle flight just to test if it worked. It was a proof of concept flight years ago, and it worked. So that was it. They decided let's build a permanent one and put it on the space station. Let's let it last, you know, 3 or 4 years. And it did, and it's gone beyond that point. The problem is, it does have cooling pumps, and the pumps are starting to fail. And there's only one left. So what they did is they sent up on one of the cargo flights to the space station 4 new pumps. It's they're all kind of like put together on one skid. And this mission is not to actually cut the old pumps out and throw them away. They're just going to leave them there. But their goal is to cut all these pipes. And there's 8 pipes that they have to cut. Actually, 9. But there's 8. Correction. There's 8 cuts that they have to make. They have to, you know, each one has a supply, you know, a suction and a discharge. So supply and return. And they've got to cut these, and they've got to tap into them, and then reroute them to these 4 pumps that they brought up. All these pipes contain carbon dioxide as a refrigerant. You know, you could use carbon dioxide as a refrigerant. It will get you to very low temperatures. So what they did is on this EVA, you know, there's going to be at least four EVAs to do this job. They didn't get a chance to cut any pipes. That's planned for a later EVA. They just need to set things up. They need to bring all these tools out to the work site. There's 29 different tools, specialized tools that they made for this. I saw a news conference and they showed some of them. Intricate type of tools that you could use with space gloves on to do this very fine type of work. So I find it very interesting as a mechanic to see how these guys are going to do this. It's hard enough to, you know, place little piping and stuff, you know, in the real world. Can't imagine doing it in zero G, flying around with the Earth below 50 miles, and having daylight and darkness come every 45 minutes, you know, and then work with these heavy type of gloves. You know, the gloves are all heated and everything. From years ago, they really improved on the gloves, but it's still very tiring. And they're going to have to work on taking these things apart and making this thing come back to life. So anyway, this EVA, the first one was just to get out there, set everything up, and then they had to take a big panel apart. That's covering the pump section and all the piping that they have to cut. And this panel, you know, if you look at it, it says, you know, AMS. It's got the logo on it, the AMS 2. They actually call it AMS 2 because AMS 1 was that first one that the Nobel laureate talked NASA into putting onto a shuttle. That they found that worked. They call this AMS 2. It is a beautiful logo and everything. And you look at it, they got 13 different fasteners. And they can't just cut a fastener and let it float off into space. Each fastener that they cut has to be put into a box that will be eventually brought back into the space station. You can't just let this thing float free. But what you can float free is this massive panel. It looks like about the size of a panel on a door, you know, on a car. And it's about that kind of shape. So it was Morgan's job to take the panel. You know, Luker cut the panel off and eventually gave it to Morgan. Roughly too big to bring through the airlock. I have no use for it anyway, so their job was to just get rid of it. So they threw it in the opposite way of the direction of the International Space Station, the way it's going. This way it won't come back and hit them again. So you throw it backwards in the direction where it winds up below you, let's put it that way. And you can see it floating away in space. Here's this beautiful panel with AMS-2 written all over it, heading off to eventually burn up in the atmosphere. This is WS2. Any questions, comments about this topic or any of the other topics?
Paul, I think you were talking about Samuel Ting.
Thank you, Roy. Yes, I've heard him talk, and that's right. Roy, he's the one that came up with this. I do you know anything about him, or I do know he was a Nobel laureate, and he came up with this whole theory of how this was all going to work, and he explained how it was all going to work one time years ago, and he got everything approved, but. Back to you, Roy, if you have any info.
Yeah, he did some research on things called pi mesons. They're very fascinating things. He got he did his research around 1974. He got a Nobel Prize in 1976, and he's been a big proponent of this program that you're talking about. So he's been kind of pushing it as hard as he can. He's a very, very small man, kind of elderly at this point. He's in his early 80s.
Yeah, and he's following it like he was 20. When I heard he's really into this, and he wants to get the science, of course, back from it. So he pushed it, and it's his baby, you know. So very good. Thanks for that, Roy. Any other comments or questions? Okay, SpaceX is being contracted by NASA. You know, they got billions of dollars. I think it was $2.5 billion at one point to get a contract for sending cargo to the space station. Then they got another $4-point-something billion contract to eventually develop a crew vehicle. And that's under development. So far, they've sent a crew vehicle to the space station once, without a crew, just to test to see if it could get up there, if it could get back. It did successfully. When it was up there, they actually had astronauts go inside, sit in the chairs, did a photo op, and eventually, and in fact, they had a robot in there as well, or mannequins with all kinds of precious sensors and everything on it. Make sure everything was going to go okay. Successfully landed in the Pacific, in the Atlantic Ocean when it came back, because that's where they had to be able to do that. They plan on landing in the Atlantic once they have a crew on board. Well, that spacecraft came back, and they were going to test it for a board test. They needed to qualify with NASA. The idea is to put this onto a live Falcon 9 rocket, shoot it up about, 10, 12 miles when it gets the maximum Q. That's where the most pressure is against the vehicle, and that's due to the speed in the atmosphere. Whatever that location is, I think it's roughly, 10 miles up or so. And at that point, they need to separate from the Falcon 9. They're duplicating a booster failure, and the Dragon will, push itself away. And it's got the Super Draco engines on it. Super Draco engines, the liquid engines. It's got 8 of them. They have regular Draco engines. Draco engines are the same fuel, and they use it for maneuvering in space. But these Super Draco engines are used for getting away from the booster. Original plans were they were going to use this for a propulsive landing and bring it all the way back to Earth. But they did away with that idea and it finally went with parachutes. But these engines are so powerful. I mean, collectively, I think it's 160,000 pounds of thrust. The flight that went up in March and came back successfully and landed in the Atlantic, and they put it onto this make-believe booster in Florida, simulating a booster. And they just wanted to test the engine, test all the thrusters, all the Draco engines, and then test the Super Draco engines. They went to do that, and it failed. They got a slug of liquid from the fuel. From the liquid nitrogen, liquid, was it, laughing gas, tetroxide. This slug of liquid, as a liquid, not a gas, came flying back, crashed past their, hit their check valve, which made titanium, broke that apart, and it quickly mixed with the hypergolic gas, and the whole thing blew up. I mean, there wasn't a piece left of this spacecraft, the crew vehicle. So, I mean, it was what they call a RUD, a rapid, unscheduled disassembly. So that's what happened to that thing. It was gone. So they ran all the tests, and they found out what the problem was. This liquid slug had gone back and got past the check valve, broke the check valve. They decided to use burst disc is like if you took two flanges and you put a gasket in between, a special gasket, and that's designed to only blow at a certain pressure. You can do anything you want, and I think that we're going to blow until you get to that pressure. So that's what they did. They put these things in instead of these check valves, which allows only the check valve only allows fuel to go in one direction. They have this flapper on the inside that stops it from going the other way. Now these burst flanges were put in, and they ran a test last week, and the same thing. They put it onto a make-believe booster in Florida. Ran a test, and this time everything worked. The burst just went when it was supposed to. This way, proper mixture took place at the proper time. The eight Draco engines fired, duplicating, a successful test of those rocket engines. Now that that worked, within probably a month or so, they plan on putting this whole vehicle on top of a real Falcon 9 booster, blasting it towards space, not into space. It'll be in the atmosphere, and they plan on doing a test and seeing if this vehicle, which would carry up to four people, will successfully separate and then land in the Atlantic Ocean under four parachutes. Hopefully that works, and if it works, we'll report on that. One other quick comment, there's a company in Brooklyn, I think it's over near the Navy, Brooklyn Navy Yard, but there's a company, it's called Launcher, that's the name of the company, Launcher, and there's a fellow there that's been doing this with a small crew, and he's trying to eventually build his own rocket, and he's already successfully made engines, and the engines he's made are 100% made out of, on a 3D additive manufacturing, 3D machine. And he's already built them. I think it's a meter high, but, they're not gigantic engines, but they're still big. And he's eventually putting nine of these into a rocket that he's building. And hopefully he'll be able to get this thing off the ground by 2024. But to do that, naturally, he needs more money. So he knew there was a competition by the U.S. Air Force out in San Francisco, I think it was held out in California. And he went out there, and, you have a lot of these companies competing for this money to get these things. And sure enough, this guy in Brooklyn won. So I was glad to hear that, because I read about him about a year or so ago. He tested a small rocket, the rocket engine itself, out in Calverton, out in Brookhaven, out here by me. And I saw the little YouTube that he had on that, and that was pretty interesting. But that was a year or so ago, and much from it. And now all of a sudden he's on one of the main websites that I frequent. I read about this guy and his E2 rocket engine, 3D built, and he's got a $1.5 million developing money from the government. So hopefully he does something with it. His theory is we have a lot of smart people in Brooklyn, in New York City area. What are we doing going off to all these other places? We built the LEM here. The Philander Moon. So I like this guy. Anyway, that's pretty much all for the Space Night Report. This is WS2. I'm going to turn it over to Dick and see if he has any comments. And back to you, Dick.
Be with you in a second. Stand by.
Well, be here. Not going anywhere. And let's see, tomorrow we have the club info net, so that's at 8 o'clock on, 8:30 on this repeater. So over you, Dick.
Let me go back one subject. Alpha magnetic spectrometer, you said was 2.5 billion with a B. My goodness, that sounds expensive. Any idea what the expensive component on that was? After the Challenger disaster, we had to build another space shuttle, and I think the brand new space shuttle 25 years ago, was around $2.5 billion. So you could build a whole space shuttle back then for $2.5 billion, and now you build this one piece of test hardware, alpha magnetic spectrometer. There must be a lot of gold or platinum or something in here that's very expensive. I guess the neodymium super big magnet is probably one of the more expensive items. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess. How do you design this? And it's got these coils. I've seen close-ups of these coils after coils. I think there's six main coils, and they can detect where the particles come in from and all. Yeah, probably the 6,000, and that's, I'm not kidding, 6,000 neodymium magnets that are all perfectly shaped. And not a sphere, but like a pipe. Maybe, I don't know, it looks like about a foot and a half high, maybe about 2 feet in diameter, something like that. And there's magnets that are epoxied together, one right after the other. Maybe that was part of the cost, I would imagine that, that the CO2 system with these pumps and everything, they didn't need an electrical system because they were hooking up to the shuttle, so they're picking up the power from that. It draws a lot of power. I forget how many watts this thing heats up, but it does heat up a lot of power for the coils back to there.
6,000 neodymium magnets. Wow. I can understand why they use neodymium instead of electromagnets, because neodymium magnet, although it's a little bit expensive in the beginning, you don't have to supply power to it to get magnetism. And in magnetic field per volume, neodymium probably is pretty close to the maximum you can get. Maybe an electromagnet could exceed that if you're willing to use cryogenic cooling of the coil as an electromagnet. But cryogenic cooling is something where the gas runs out and you've got to restore it, and so that would be a problem. Wow, what a machine. Okay, we've essentially run out of time. Good stuff. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Roy. Anybody want to make any final comments? Go right ahead. KTRIW clear. Bye-bye for now. See you guys next week. And by the way, I counted number 99 for Roy. I've been counting. And there was at least 1 week in which we had canceled the TechNet. So maybe that's part of the difference between my 99 and your 100, but close enough. KTRIW clear, but listening.
Yeah, close enough for government work, I always say. Very good. And it was originally supposed to be superconductor coils, but that went out the window for cost.
Not only cost, but the only way you can get a superconducting coil is to bathe it in liquid helium, and liquid helium has to be continuously boiling off to supply the cryogenic temperature, which means you're going to be running out of that, and it'd be a real problem restoring it from time to time, and therefore the machine would be not on the air continuously. You'd like to have it on the air continuously so that when some of those negative polarity particles come from deep space with high energy, you don't want to miss any of them. Okay, I think the alpha magnetic spectrometer has detected a few antiparticles. Isn't that true, Paul?
Yeah, I've read that it did, but I'm not up on science enough to really discuss it. But and they could have gotten a higher magnetic field with the superconducting magnets, but they, for the reasons you stated, they went with neodymium, and I think they wanted 3 or 4 years out of it, and that's what they got. Now that's it. They got such good results out of the testing with this, looking at the stuff, they plan on keeping this to the end of the space station, which could be at least another 10 years. 73, guys. Go Limark, go Technic. Back to you. I think Roy wanted to say something.
You got it, Roy.
Okay, very well. Thank you, Dick. Thank you, Paul. Want to remind everyone, if you have mailbag questions, Dick, if you have spacer questions for Paul, if you have any questions or topics or puzzlers for me, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And all the stories have links, and the YouTubes that I talked about have links on my page, roy.ac2gs.com. And as a side thing about that spectroscopy device, it was estimated at $33 million originally in 1999, and it ended up being $2 billion. You got to love the government with their estimations. Anyway, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, and thanks again for the opportunity, and we'll be back next week to do it all over again. So this is C2GS, and I'll be clear.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Good morning, the time is 5 o'clock a.m. This is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. L repeater.
KA2YHY from WB2LFD.
Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
KE2SBO listening, mobile.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.